talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome to our first show of the new year. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan, and you are very welcome back for another year of talking history. In tonight's show, crime, punishment and prosecution in Ireland as we investigate the history of the office of the DPP, starvation and death during sieges in Irish history and the lengths people went to survive, and then to end the show, the mysteries of bog butter, Irish cookbooks, 72 words for potato, and the history of Ireland's culinary soul. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with the history of the DPP. This year marks 50 years since Ireland established the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions, established to provide a framework for independence and integrity in our criminal justice system. And to commemorate this anniversary, legal historian Dr. Niamh Hallin of the Sutherland School of Law in UCD and the Vice President of the Irish Legal History Society has written a history of the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions, 1975 to 2025. It was launched by the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, who remarked that the book shines a light on the office many challenges, milestones, and ultimately its place at the heart of Ireland's criminal justice system. And it draws on newly digitised archives, first-hand interviews, and reveals how the office became one of the state's most trusted institutions. And indeed, the book can be found online on the DPP's website, dppireland.ie. Niamh, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Patrick.
It's a very interesting anniversary. It's a significant office, and I think it's important that it is being marked on the 50th anniversary. But it's probably a history that maybe the regular person won't be very familiar with.
I think that's right. I think it's possibly to the strength of the Office of the DPP that most of us don't know very much about them and what they do. I think they just work in the background, and most people have a sort of vague awareness that files are sent to the DPP. And beyond that, I think most of us don't really think about them much more.
And why was it established in 1975? What was the logic? What was the thinking behind it?
So up until the 1970s, all criminal prosecutions were taken by the Attorney General. So the Attorney General is essentially the chief legal officer in the state. And that's a position that's set out in the Constitution. And if we want to think about why the Director of Public Prosecutions was established, we need to think about what was happening in Ireland in the early 70s. So what was happening in Dublin, what was happening up north, and what was happening in Europe. So in Northern Ireland, at that stage, most prosecutions were conducted by officers from the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And with the outbreak of civil unrest in 1969, 1970, there were a number of controversies and recommendations to change the role of the police in criminal prosecutions up north. And when there was an escalation of violence in 1972 with Bloody Sunday and other bombings, legislation was passed which established a DPP, a Director of Public Prosecutions for Northern Ireland. So this diminished the role of the RUC. And I think it was generally welcomed at that time.
And the very first holder of the office, the very first Director of Public Prosecutions, was a remarkable man, Eamon Barnes. And he held the office for 24 years until his retirement in 1999. So he really did set it up, establish it, ensure that it was respected and trusted, and provided all of those crucial, foundations in those early years. And tell us about him and tell us about, I suppose, how he set up the office and, I suppose, his approach to the job.
So Eamon Barnes was a barrister who went to work in the office of the Attorney General. And when he was in the Attorney General's office, he did have some responsibility for directing prosecutions as part of his role there. And he was also involved in the talks and the plans to establish a new DPP. So he was, right from the start, he was helping to draft the legislation which ultimately set up the office. So once that legislation was passed in 1974, there was an open competition. Anyone who had the right legal experience could apply for the job. And Eamon Barnes was one of three people who were shortlisted by a committee. And so the committee consisted of people like the Chief Justice, the head of the legal professions, and so on. So they recommended a shortlist of three to the Taoiseach, and the Taoiseach appointed Eamon Barnes. And as the first office holder, as the first DPP, I would say he was really dynamic in the way that he set everything up. So he was involved in everything from, you know, the big picture ideas of how the office was going to be independent and free from political influence, right down to the nitty gritty of trying to kit out an office and find books and office furniture for things to run. So I'd say he was very dynamic in the role.
He also occasionally engaged with the media, and I loved in your account the interviews with the Irish Press in 1979, and he did some with the Irish Times in the 80s. He appeared on Liveline in 1995 with the original presenter Marion Finucane and taking questions from listeners, which I think annoyed some in the government because he wasn't going before the Dáil. So he knew that it was important to explain. He didn't like explaining why they didn't bring cases, because he thought that would create an unfortunate precedent where you'd be having to give justifications every single time. But he was very robust when it came to defending the office and explaining the role of the office.
Yes, I think that he was. I think it's fair to say that Eamon Barnes wanted people to have a better understanding of what his role was and what it wasn't. And he wanted members of the public to understand what the limits of the prosecution role is. So, for example, some people think that that the DPP has a role in investigating cases, whereas the investigation is done by the guards, and then the DPP decides whether there's enough there to take a case. So he did do a few media interviews over the years. And he did, as you say, go on Liveline at one point to defend his position.
Talk about some of the controversies then, and it usually is when a prosecution either fails or isn't brought. And at the time of the Malcolm MacArthur trial, he brought a case against him for one of the murders, but not the other. And there were criticisms of that, and again he refused to give the explanations because he thought that would mean you would have to do it in every single time, and it would result in maybe almost condemning someone without trial if you were to discuss it. But you know, there were times when there was public unease about maybe prosecutions not taken.
Yes, and I think, you know, the cases that attracted the most controversy, they're always ones where we as members of the public or members of the media or the press, we don't have the full story. And that was the case, I think, in the MacArthur case. You know, the case is very well known and you've talked about it before. Malcolm MacArthur killed Bridie Gargan and Donald Dunn, but was only prosecuted for the murder of Bridie Gargan. And the decision of the DPP not to prosecute for that second case was very controversial, and there was a lot of pressure coming on the office publicly and politically to explain why that decision had been taken. So the DPP at that time was quite firm that they wouldn't give reasons, and that was one of the instances where Eamon Barnes released a press statement trying to set out the position.
It's a wonderful volume, and what I love is that there are these great documents that were prepared and produced in conjunction with the National Archives, and so you get these, you know, lovely images of texts and documents throughout the time, but then you also combined it with these wonderful interviews where you're able to talk to people involved, and so you're getting the documentary evidence, but you're also getting the personal insights and all of that. If there's a sense that maybe you had fun getting maybe behind the scenes with some of the things that probably even people involved in the law weren't aware of.
Yeah, I think that's I think I've been quite lucky with this project. When you do some historical research that's fairly recent, there are still people around who remember, who have first-hand experience, who you can talk to and interview. So it was a very enjoyable part of the of the process to get to interview past DPPs and people who worked in the office in different capacities. And I think you're right. I think if you have that kind of first-hand narrative or those first-hand experiences, it can really bring to life some of the documentary evidence that's there as well.
And the role seems to be always evolving. The office is always changing as society and the world changes. And under the new DPP, Catherine Pearce, you see this emphasis on victims' rights, and there is aware of the changing digital landscape. And it's very much an office that is responding to a changing world and really how the criminal justice system has to be able to adapt to meet that.
I think you're right. If we look at the original backdrop to the establishment of the office, it was the Troubles in the North, and it was also Ireland's accession to the EEC, because that was creating a huge amount of workload for the Attorney General. And every decade since has had some kind of political or social change or upheaval that the office of the DPP has had to respond to. So even in this century, we can think about the financial crash, Brexit, the COVID-19 pandemic. Each of those big societal issues had an impact on crime and criminal prosecutions that the office has had to respond to.
There is a wonderful quote from, I think, the deputy DPP one time, Barry Dunhu, who said that the worst thing you can have in a democracy is a popular DPP. But speaking at the launch of your book, the present DPP, Catherine Pearce, said that that line really resonated with her. And I can kind of see where they were coming from, that it's not about courting popularity. It's about making the tough decisions and sometimes being criticised for them. But that democracy is best served when you are independent and when you're not trying to score points or popularity or make sure you get a good headline in the newspaper the next day.
I think that's something we can take for granted in our system. You know, the DPP isn't a political appointment. They're not affiliated to any political party. They're free from political influence. In other countries, it's not like that. Public prosecutors might be politically appointed, or they might be voted in by the public. So they have this other consideration. They have to take the popular decision or the decision that's going to get them headlines or get them votes. I think we're very lucky in our system that we don't have those concerns. It's a real strength of our system that the DPP is independent, and I think it's something to celebrate.
And also, really interesting the way the office itself has grown from, I think, only four people in the early years to suddenly now a huge operation. And again, that shows, I think they list the numbers of judges that we even had in Ireland in 1975 and how the judiciary has grown in that time. And you're really getting a sense of a changing Ireland as well, changing society, changing institutions. And as we engage more with the world, with the EC now the EU, it has required all this growth as well.
Yes, I think everything is growing and expanding. We have more legislation being passed every year. We have more judges, more lawyers, more court sittings, more prosecutions, and more crime statistics, more crime being prosecuted. And I suppose it has been necessary for the office of the DPP to grow with everything else.
Is there anything that surprised you when you were researching this? Because you're a legal expert, a legal historian. I wonder, when you were conducting your interviews and when you were going through the archives, was there something that you thought, wow, I never actually knew that, I never realised that, and it maybe gave you a new understanding or maybe even a new respect for the work that you were writing about?
Well, one thing that did surprise me was the level of detail in the records in the National Archives when it came to setting up the office of the DPP. There are lists of books that they wanted to buy, newspapers that they wanted to subscribe to, the type of typewriter and calculator that they wanted to buy. And I suppose when we think about these big state institutions, we're thinking about things on a big scale. And I suppose I hadn't really thought about the necessity to get into the nitty-gritty. So every big organisation still has to have all of these small things and small decisions that have to be made.
And Eamon Barnes was sometimes critical of the fact that there wasn't enough funding and there wasn't enough staffing. And so he was prepared to fight for the greater resources so that they could better do their job.
Yes, I think that's something that we see with successive DPPs and also in other sectors. I mean, every part of the criminal justice system really is underfunded and is crying out for more investment.
And it is hugely trusted. It is hugely respected. And that seems to have come fairly early on, I think.
Yes, I think the way that the legislation was drafted and the way that the first office holder ran the office of the DPP did a lot to establish public confidence.
And that public confidence still exists today. And the DPP celebrating its 50th anniversary and a wonderful new book by Niamh Howlan, which you can find online on the DPP website, dppireland.ie. It's called A History of the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. Dr. Niamh Howlan of the Sutherland School of Law at UCD. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history. Siege was the defining experience of the grindingly brutal and consequential wars of religion in Ireland between 1641 and 1653. Civilians were more likely to encounter siege warfare as participants and as victims than any other kind of military action. And a new book brilliantly tells the story of their experiences. It's called Siege in Ireland, 1641 to 53, Blood and Stone. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press. The author is Pádraig Lenihan. And Pádraig, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me on.
I have to say, I absolutely love the book. And I love the book because it really brings you, it's like you have a handheld camera and you are taking the reader through this whole experience. And we get to see it from the point of view of the attackers and the defenders and things like the psychological and physical consequences of being blockaded in, what it was like to be besieged and the types of things you experienced in terms of isolation and hunger and sickness and growing despair. And you really do get that sense of what participants would have experienced during this period.
Well, thank you for that. It was to do to some extent with the source material. You're familiar with, in Irish history, the depositions, the 1641 depositions, and they're very problematic evidence. But what they are is an unusually large body of civilian experience, capturing the civilian experience of war and especially of blockade and siege warfare. And all of those things you talk about, the growing sense of despair, the fear, the likelihood of death. I mean, sickness consequent on on contagion and confinement. So the depositions capture that experience. And they're, by European standards, I'm not aware of any other body of reported experience that is so big and so vividly expressed. And I've used that as much as possible to illuminate the experience on both sides, because sometimes they're talking about reported speech of the attackers and what the attackers are, sort of conversations, and the attackers are saying why we did this and why we did the other. And it's, so I'm pleased about that. And I tried to put figures as well on, or quantify what's happening. And looking at, in the winter of 1641-42, when that was peak, there were literally everywhere from, let's say around that loan, there were maybe a couple of hundred people blockading that place, your Burr, Newcastle West. You multiply that right across Offaly, Leash, Kilkenny, Tipperary, Limerick, areas that had been settled in the 17th century. There's an awful lot of activity going on there, an awful lot of people tied down, and the depositions capture that. So I'm pleased about that. You're looking at the figures then, you're looking at maybe anything from, I worked out, 2 to 4% of people in those places are dying every week. So ultimately, the siege can't, after a couple of months of that tight blockade, surrender is inevitable.
Pádraig, no one is safe. That's the thing. You show how officers are dying at large rates. Civilians are suffering even more. And it's not really even combat that's the real killer. It's disease. It's all of these other factors. And even the fact that there's such food shortages.
Well, the problem from the insurgents, if you like, for the first maybe 9 months after October 1641 is that they don't have guns. And they try to capture places by surprise. That works for a while, but obviously you can only use trickery so often. Escalate, trying to climb over with ladders, very dangerous. Trying to batter the walls using shelters or sows. Trying to set the place on fire. None of those work. You usually don't work, so you have to settle down and blockade the place. In that, depending on how tight or loose the blockade is, the combatants there are people going out from the castles looking for food, cleaning for food, foraging. So they're the ones that are in the firing line. And most of the direct killing is, and quite brutal killing, because the besiegers will often capture those poor unfortunates and kill them and display their bodies to pour encourager les autres, to discourage the people inside from coming out to. So you've got the, from going out to forage. So you have this hardship, and you have the, as I was saying, the diseases of contagion and confinement. Disease and cold are the killers. One of the things I've tried to do in the book is to set this experience in a context. And the context is, it's part of a three-kingdom war. We don't, I think, as historians, look at closely enough, surprisingly, as what's happening in England and in Scotland at the same time. I mean, they're experiencing the same, predominantly siege warfare, and many of the things that happen in Ireland can best be understood by putting it in that context. Even something like a singular in our minds as Drogheda, and that was bad. That was the sack of Drogheda, the massacre. It is an outlier in a British context. So kind of facile generalizations about, well, that's the way war was, and there were no laws. There were laws, there were expectations, there were customs and norms. And Ireland was a little bit, quite an outlier in that context, more so than Scotland, which itself was an outlier of warfare in England. So there are degrees. My point is that setting events in a context, like using, in that case, the quote from Basinghouse, illuminates, I think, and gets us away from the idea of Irish exceptionalism, where it's not all that different in kind from what's happening elsewhere.
You have a powerful chapter entitled Storm, and it's not a chapter about the weather, but about these incredible encounters of terror and courage when you have these dramatic assaults on the fortifications, and exactly what was required: a breach created by artillery, and then close assault troops advancing under fire, and then the men pushing forward, and then a fragile tipping point where if enough hesitated, the attack would fail, and that there's tactical and technical considerations, and there's sometimes surrenders, and there's sometimes defined resistance. But these are incredible encounters.
Yeah, I've been trying to capture the psychology, and it's unimaginable almost, but you try to, as a historian, try to put yourself in the shoes, in the boots of people who are being driven, not led, as driven unwillingly into a breach. What's a breach? They're clambering over this. The wall has been knocked down. There's a pile of rubble in front of the wall. They have to climb over that. It's all quiet. They don't know what's on the other side until they do. And they're over the other side. And the nightmare scenario is the defenders have built another U-shaped wall inside. And they're going into, and the word is often used, a pound or a pen. Somewhere where animals are kept. And they're in that. And if two things will happen, either A, they press on through it, or B, they'll pull back out and over the breach. And the longer they wait before that, either one of those two things happen, the greater the carnage. And Clonmel is an interesting one. I think I look carefully at the figures there. Again, I'm a little bit maybe obsessed with that. We talk about 2,000 people. Nonsense. It couldn't have been that high. I mean, looking at comparative context of sieges like Leicester in 16, storms like Leicester in 1645, Bristol again in 1645, that wasn't. Those figures are very implausible. But 500 to 1,000 men killed in a few short hours. And you can then understand the gravity of Oliver's mistake in sending all his troops through in daylight, through one narrow breach or break in the wall, rather than simultaneously attacking a few places. He broke all the rules. He usually got away with it. He did it rather. But this time, his carelessness, as it were, caught up with him. So I find that idea, the tipping point, the psychology of the storm, the gut-wrenching fear, the silence, then the explosions and the chaos. That's something that I've tried to explain.
You do capture that so well. And then the final chapter is about the sack, because if the storm is successful, then it leads to the sack of the city or the area. And it can be so violent and devastating in the amount of plunder and destruction. And you do these kind of comparisons with European sacks as well, to get a sense of what the Irish experience was like compared to these other ones. And you do capture just how chaotic and traumatic and violent that was.
Thank you. We're trying to, and here we have the evidence again of the depositions, but I try to use archaeological evidence. The siege of Carrick Mines in March 1642, the garrison marches out from Dublin and takes brings a cannon, and the place is stormed. Basically, the main door is knocked down and the soldiers pile in. And we know from documentary evidence that 300 odd are killed inside. And that's lines in a news book. But when you see or you read the partial graves that are recovered, and you see the mute testimony of the archaeology, most of them are injured by marks on their right back of their head, on the right-hand side, where they were struck in the anterior position. In other words, they were struck from above repeatedly by somebody while they were crouched or kneeling from behind. So you can imagine you can picture people crowding through a door, crowding up a stairs, being caught and being slashed in a fury, a frenzy by the attackers. And why is it? It's frenzied because the bodies still have their clothes on them. And the clothes sometimes have money. They recovered 30 shillings in the clothesline, which is soldiers, a fortnight's, 3 weeks' pay for a soldier. So you're looking at a lot of a windfall that was ignored. These guys are so incensed, so enraged, they don't even search the bodies. They're just they're running amok. So Carrick Mines is very evocative like that. The other ones, there's another siege of that would be less well known, of Dysart in County Leash by O'Neill's army. And again, the depositions capture the killing of most of the soldiers, except those who are Catholics, who were able to pass themselves off as O'Neill's men by using the Irish passwords, Sancta Maria, the opening words of the Hail Mary. So again, the depositions give you an idea of the ambience, the context, and the survival strategies of those who survived.
Porrick, it's a very powerful book, and I think it's a book that has a lot that will resonate with readers when they think about civilians being caught up in brutal conflicts. The book is called Siege in Ireland, 1641-53, Blood and Stone. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press. The author is Porrick Lenihan. And Porrick, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Patrick, thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. Well, to end the show tonight, we're going to go on a surprising voyage through the flavours that shaped a nation, beginning in the shadow of the Ice Age when reindeer roamed and giant deer thundered across the landscape. A new book follows the island's transformation through the arrival of farming, the mysteries of bog butter, the sweetness of medieval honey, the theatre of banqueting and the craft of distilling. We find out about feasts, famines, rituals and ingenious techniques long forgotten as we explore Ireland's culinary soul and how we learn to eat, survive Alive, Celebrate and Imagine. The book is called Irish Food History, A Companion. It's published in hardback by the Royal Irish Academy and published online by EUT Plus Academic Press. It's edited by Dr. Martine McConnamara, a chef, culinary historian and senior lecturer in the School of Culinary Arts and Food Technology and co-PI at Technological University Dublin's Centre for Irish Studies, and Dr. Dorothy Cashman, culinary historian specialising in the history of the recipe in Ireland through manuscript and print. Well, you're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Martine, can I begin with you and maybe a question about, well, maybe the scale of the book. This is an incredibly ambitious undertaking. There are 28 chapters. It is, you know, I think 800 pages. There is a huge amount here, and it takes us through, you know, very much the beginnings of the story to the development of modern Irish food and identity. So talk to me about the scale of the book and its ambition and what you were trying to achieve with it.
Well, I suppose I've been interested in the history of Irish food for, I suppose, quarter of a century, and realising that it goes back as far back as it goes, and reading through the different disciplines, the different archaeologists, the people involved in literature, the folklorists, all the different specialities. And I sort of had the idea, I says, wouldn't it be great to actually draw them all together and draw on all their various expertise and bring it in one volume? But it was brilliant, like reaching out. I had read like J.P. Mallory's The Origin of the Irish. You know, I had visited Seamus Caulfield with my students down in the Cager Fields. You know, I knew so many of these different people. But when I reached out to them, you know, I'd read so much of Finbar McCormack stuff as well, you know. But to reach out to them and then, you know, the fact that they were willing to do this, you know, I was so excited. And then the magic when actually the email comes in and the finished chapter comes in, and you know the beauty of them, you know what I mean, they're just gorgeous. Like, there was very little work for us to do really in the editing on so many of these chapters, but it was amazing. So really, that's the idea, trying to bring them all in one place. You know, the Royal Irish Academy had brought out a special issue of their proceedings on food and drink in Ireland. So what we tried to do with this volume is make sure that we weren't duplicating anything that was already done there, that we were. So we're not saying that this is the full picture, you know, but what it is that this is picking up some of the gaps, and I'm sure there'd be room for a volume two and maybe even a volume three.
Well, it may not be the full picture, but it does provide a very complete picture. It begins with a section on prehistory and the archaeology of food in Ireland, a second section on bog butter, bees and banqueting in medieval Ireland. Then it goes up to sources for food history in early modern Ireland. You're then on to developments in food supply, technology and trade, food folklore, digital humanities, and all the way up to the developments in the present day. And as you mentioned there, some of the scholars involved, an incredible array of scholars as well, young and old, some retired, some still involved and working, that, but each bringing their own insights and perspectives and their own, in some cases, decades of experience to these areas.
Yeah, and some of them had never actually written this down. You know, for Seamus Caulfield particularly, Seamus was such an amazing speaker and such an amazing tour guide and such an amazing, broadcaster. But actually, he'd never really written his story down, you know. So to get that story on print, you know what I mean, from someone as amazing as him, you know, and again, there's other people who've written so much and all that sort of stuff. But think of Toby Barnard. Like, Toby Barnard's magical chapter about food in the 18th century, which sort of avoids what so many people do in looking at the food of the high and the low. And he covers both high and low, but very much covers the middling classes as well, which is what's often forgotten in the study of food and in the study of history. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's the beauty, the nuance, you know, the level of different classes, different locations, different geographies, etc., and the various influences that happen, you know, is really important.
Dorothy, you have a wonderful chapter on cookery notes, and it's about the history of some of these cookbooks in Ireland, and talk to me about that and some of the tensions that arose when some of these women were trying to present their cookbooks and their materials.
Cookery notes had long fascinated me because there's no authorship attributed to it at all, and I'd see different dates of publication referred to by different scholars. I just thought there's something about this that doesn't quite add up. So I was very lucky that somebody actually pointed me in the direction of the National Archives, because I hadn't really thought that an archive relating to a cookbook would be available there. And there I went in, and there was the whole archive, and there was the whole story of Marian Laird in a fascinating thick folder from the very beginning up until sort of, you know, the latest publication, the last publication, which is the one with the red cover. Yeah, she was effectively anonymised by being... She was conscious of the fact that her work was very valuable and it was a very important record and very useful, as can be seen by the fact that it circulated all around the country and the huge number of copies that were printed. But and she was proud of it, and she thought, well, you know, it was available initially to the Munster Institute and to people who were girls who were doing the courses, and she thought, well, if this is going to be sold to the public, why shouldn't I, you know, be get some money for it? And she wrote this whole file to do with it about writing to the civil servants and saying, you know, should I not be rewarded? And the answer, you know, that the civil servants thought about this and they came back to her, and it's so carefully couched, you know, that she'd be given a gratuity, and that would really, that would be the end of her name, and they would hold all the rights to it. In fact, I think it's prime for republication now, and with her name on it.
And because she stood up for herself and insisted on getting paid for the work that she had done, the officials decided, well, if we're going to pay her, then...
She gives up all rights.
And generations go through not knowing that she had a crucial role to play in this.
Crucial role. And I mean, nobody knows about her. And it wasn't even that her name was taken off it. Because it was a teaching manual, and it's common with teaching manuals, the names, the authors are kind of disappeared into the coursework, or, you know, something like that. So it's just, I just think she's a very important person to know about in terms of Irish culinary history, as are all of those domestic science teachers back in that day, because they did really shape the way we see food and cookery and what is put on our table.
And there's a wonderful illustration of the cover page of a 1959 edition of Cookery Notes, and it has that very distinctive red cover. There is also conflict and tension over particular recipes and names for things. And
I think men write themselves out of the story of food very often. She was prepared to overrule at different times in the way things were done. But there's the whole discussion about Barnbrack and how it should be referred to. Should it be Barnbrack? And she said no, Barnbrack. And it's just a fascinating cultural exchange, actually, between two different sides of the Irish food story.
Yeah, I've never known that. Which is the correct one? Will I go with her or Martine? Is it Barm and, well, and the way...
What it stems from is this, is that the Barn Brack with the N comes from the Irish, which is the Badin Brack. So Badin is the Irish for a loaf, and the Brack means speckled. And that means that it has sort of, you know, sultanas or currants or raisins in it. Now, traditionally, a Badin Brack might have been made with soda bread or you know, sort of a bit like what's a spotted dick, you know, or railway cake or kerny bread or whatever like that. But the Barn Part is so, it's associated with sort of post the Norman invasion here, as in the idea about the Normans brought with them the concept of the built-up oven and that idea about yeast bread. So the barm with the M is to do with barm, which is the yeast that comes off ale, which would have been used as a leavening agent to make this in sort of more of an industrial or more of a bakery style. It's more, I suppose, town and city. So in some ways, maybe the barm is to do with the town and city, and the badin then is more to do with the countryside. But yet we have to remember that the proviso of these soda breads anyway are only around 170 years old, because it's really that bread soda. You know, this thing that we think is the quintessential Irish food as an Irish soda bread, only appeared, you know, around the 1840s with the idea of bread soda, you know, and then that magical thing that bread soda could mix with the freely available buttermilk, you know, that had the acid, the bread soda had the alkaline, then you had soft flour in Ireland, you know, and Irish soft flour is no good for yeast bread, you know what I mean, because it's low in gluten, and then a bit of salt. So there we go.
You co-author a wonderful chapter on the potato, and the point is made in the introduction of the book that too often the story of the potato in Irish history is just there for the story of the famine. And when we talk about food, it tends to be when it comes to food shortages and famines and disasters and things going wrong. Whereas there is a much wider, a much richer history. And actually, in that chapter on the potato, 72 words for potato, it shows how the potato plays such a central role in the Irish food story over such a long period, and it's a very rich, it's a very nuanced story.
Absolutely, and I suppose you can tell from the title that I was sort of nodding towards the late Monchan McGann's 32 words for field with the 72 words for potato. But yeah, you know, the potato is sort of much aligned. There's a woman, a historian out of America called Hazia Diner, who sort of wrote that, you know, the Irish never, unlike the Jewish and the Italians that she looked at in her book, Hungering for America, that the Irish rarely ever mentioned food, you know, within their writings or within their correspondence and all this sort of stuff, or within their songs. And those who did, that they never wrote about it in a discerning way. And I used to watch my father hover over the pot of potatoes. He was always steaming the potatoes because they were floury potatoes that would fall apart if you, you know, they turn into soup if you boil them. So he would steam them, gently prod them, take them out one by one. And I knew this is discernment. There's a long tradition here. And within all of the quarter days, within around Christmas time, special potato dishes, celebratory potato dishes like Culcannon and Boxty and all of these were prepared. So it wasn't just like, it could be boiled potatoes every day or for the normal people, but then there were celebratory dishes. But equally, the manuscript of Birr Castle, like there's one of the oldest recipes there for potato pudding, which is this sort of rich pudding that has sugar and spices and everything in it. So potato wasn't just for the poor or for the cottier classes as such. Potato was for everyone, and it has such a sort of dynamic history to it.
And as you say there with Boxty, there are so many different variations, and you look at terms in Donegal and different mashed potato dishes in other counties and regional variations, and what it is in Munster, and that there are all these different recipes and different ways of doing extraordinary things with the potato.
Absolutely. I've a student at the moment doing her PhD, Katrina McPhilippine, on the folklore collections. But what's amazing, she did her master's on the folklore collection, the 1937 and 39, you know, collection that was done in the Republic of Ireland or in the Free State as it was at the time. But she found out that there was a similar collection done up in the north in the 1950s, and she's actually researching those and looking at both. And she finds in her research, she finds the word poundies, as you say, that poundies is nearly only ever used in Donegal, you know. And again, poundies is just an anglicisation of brutine, which is the Irish for mashed potatoes, you know. And like that, you say, you know, Páirc O'Gallagher from Gallagher's Boxty House, he's actually currently finishing a master's with us in TU Dublin at the moment about Florence Irwin. But he wrote his thesis for his undergrad about Boxty, and he called it the caviar of North Longford, you know. And so it's really like that Boxty fits up with these northwestern counties, yet down in Kerry they call it Stampy, you know. And all around the country you'll see things like Stelk, and you know, so many different terms for Culcannon or Cali and all of these different terms, which is fascinating.
Dorothy, Margaret Connolly has a wonderful final chapter on the matriarch of modern Irish cooking, Myrtle Allen, who passed away in 2018. And her philosophy seems very much ahead of its time. And what was her incredible impact?
Gosh, where would you start with Myrtle Allen? She was a goddess in terms of Irish food history. And yet what she was saying was incredibly simple. Good ingredients, good produce, animals cared for, well-reared, fish straight from the sea, all prepared lovingly. You know, she encapsulated a view that technology was increasingly interfering with the product. And she wanted to keep things, at one level, it's keeping things very simple. Don't confuse things. So she has influenced such an incredible range of people. The influence it had even on Myrtle had on the Nordic movement. They acknowledged her, how important she was to them in sourcing ingredients from your locality. The importance of terroir before everything else.
And that really does seem to be so far ahead of its time. The idea of local seasonal ingredients, the idea of going from the farm to the table, and it created a new culinary language for Ireland, and as you say, influenced chefs all around the world.
It really did. But I know my mother recognised, there was a whole load of women who recognised Myrtle Allen, recognised themselves in Myrtle Allen, who were being told to buy, at that period, being told to buy cake mixes, bread mixes and things like that. Myrtle Allen gave them the courage to be themselves and say, no, this is our food, this is what we're good at. And then she elevated to another whole level. She elevated into the restaurant sphere, and where it was then acknowledged just how good she was and how important a figure she was.
This is the beauty of Myrtle. Yeah. She understood to get good food and cook it simply and present it in its sort of traditional way.
Martine, is one of the great achievements of the book that it shows there isn't a single narrative of Irish food history, that there are all these different stories and they're diverse, they're dynamic, they're interconnected. We're interconnected with global movements, that we're not just an isolated island, that really a reader will come away from this having been inspired and enraptured and enthused about so many of the different stories that are here.
Yeah, I think this is what it tells, because I'm looking, I have two daughters at the moment, and I think it's the first generation who haven't been stuck with the post-colonial shame and who realise that actually stuff from this country, like Myrtle Allen realised, stuff from this country is as good, if not better, than anywhere else in the world. But when you look at this story, you realise that we were always outward looking, we were always dynamic, we were always, you know, melding, you know, we're all mongrels. Do you know what I mean? There's no one Irish person. We've always been mongrels. People came here, people have always been coming here, you know, from whether it's the Milesians to the early Neolithic farmers, to the Vikings, to the Normans, to the Palatines, the Jews, the, you know, the new migrants who are here now, and everyone brings their food with them and their expertise and their knowledge. But then those things meld and change. Like, look at the spice bag today. Look at so much of what we do. But one of the fascinating stories I find in it is when you have a look at the bog body, Clonycavan man, and when they analysed the hair of Clonycavan man. Now, we're talking here about over 2,000 years ago, 2,300 years ago or so. You know, there was actually resin, pine resin in the hair to make this young chieftain as such look like Jedward, you know, make him look taller. And that resin came from either northern Spain or southern France. So the fact that Irish men were importing grooming products, you know, from Provence or from, you know, whatever, the Iberian Peninsula 2,000 years ago, to, you know, is not something we ever learned in history. And along with those grooming products, there would have been spices, there would have been silks, there would have been all sorts of wines and stuff like that coming. And then the export at the same time, because no boat ever leaves empty, we would have had selling them butter, hides, salmon, you know, all the rest of stuff. And later on then, once we discovered distilling, then whiskey would have gone out there later on and things like that.
Tell me about bog butter, because there is a whole section which has bog butter and bees and banqueting. But bog butter, it is an extraordinary find, and it goes back, I think, 4,000 years.
Yeah, it's wild, and it's still a mystery, you know, because there's still the debate, you know. So basically what we're talking about here is we're talking about sort of like firkins of you know, these different containers. It's not just firkins, there's lots of different types of containers. They can be wrapped in hides or wrapped in leaves or wrapped in wood or bark or all that sort of stuff. And Isabella and all down in the museum have done a wonderful job of this chapter. But we don't know whether they were placed in the ground to preserve them, whether they're placed for safekeeping, or whether they were actually votive gifts, because sometimes they're found in special places. Like I mentioned earlier on about the bog body, normally those bog bodies are found in special sort of liminal spaces between maybe two parishes or two kingdoms or such. And the same is true about a lot of the bog butter findings. There was an interesting character mentioned in this in the chapter that seemingly sampled every single one of them. Now, this going back, I think, to the 1920s or something like that, said they were all still edible or something like that. Fair play to him, you know what I mean? But One of the problems what happened in the past is that they used to sort of draw them and all that, and then they used to get rid of the butter, whereas now they hold on to them, you know what I mean, and that's, which is great. But it's a mystery. But butter, this is since the Neolithic times, and this is where Seamus Caulfield's chapter comes in, is that the cow has been sort of front and centre of Irish food. The idea about the word bóthar, which is the Irish for road. Basically, a bóthar gets its name from a bow, which is a cow. And I mean, a bóthar had to be big enough that a cow could turn around in. The word buachal or cailín, which is the Irish for boy or girl, basically means buachal, which means actually a cow herder. And then the cailín is the chil from the herder, and an ín, the diminutive thing, so little herder. So girls, Irish girls are little herders, Irish boys are cowboys. And really, our food going back, you know, 5,000 years has all been about milk, about dairy, about butter, about curds, cheeses, fermented milks, you know, all of this types of skyr and stuff that you see nowadays all over becoming fancy up in Iceland and whatever. We had it all here. We had milk in sort of 20 different types of ways, you know. And so the bog butter, it's no, you know, it's no surprise that this was to venerate the gods and keep appease the gods, you'd put butter in the ground.
Dorothy, the wonderful Grace Neville has a piece on Daniel O'Connell and food and feasts and famines, and really how much you can learn by looking at his correspondence with his wife Mary and teasing out their discussions about food and the role it plays as a backdrop to their lives.
Well, this is where the wonderful resource that is the Irish Manuscript Commission, who have all of this documentation online, freely accessible again. And you can see in Daniel O'Connell, you're the expert on this, but you can see the longing for home, the love of Kerry, and this is constantly reflected in his food and the provenance of his food. When he talks about different consumables, he's referencing that they're from Kerry. The backwards and forwards between the couple is so endearing at one level, and he's so. I mean, having learned about Daniel O'Connell in school and as the historical figure, to come and to read this correspondence is to see the human behind him and that relationship that they work out through food and through discussion. And he was very on top of exactly what he wanted.
Martine, it is a wonderful publication and it is available open access as well as in print. And I think a lot of scholarship is going that way now because funding bodies and people involved in research want to make products, outputs, research that was funded by taxpayers available to taxpayers. So,
yeah, no, I think it was really important. Like for the last 20 years or so, in TU Dublin, we were one of the first to champion the idea about open access, and we set up the Arrow repository. And I set up the Dublin Gastronomy Symposium in 2012, and all of those papers went up online. And you know, everything since has gone up online. And what's amazing is you can actually track the readership. You can track the global readership. It gives you a map every month or so of actually where your work is being read, which is brilliant. The book was awarded by the Gourmand International Awards. It was awarded the best food book published in Ireland in the last 30 years by an international group. And last year, it won the best food history book in the world.
Well, it's a beautiful production. The book is called Irish Food History, A Companion. It's published in hardback by the Royal Irish Academy and online by EUT+. It's edited by Dr. Martine McCunn-Umara, also by Dr. Dorothy Cashman. And Martine and Dorothy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, especially my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan. We'll be back next week with more debate and discussion. Hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.